Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. In a few moments I'll be shining the spotlight on famed historian, the late Jesuit, Father Robert Graham. On a Botticelli masterpiece hanging on the walls of the Sistine Chapel. And on a giant figure from our family tree of faith by the name of Moses. But first, let's join Benedict XVI in St. Peter's Square for his customary weekly general audience with pilgrims from across the world. Emma McCarthy reports.
In tracing the life and legacy of an 8th century saint, Rabanus Maurus, a fellow German and a fellow lover of the arts, the Pope said that this extraordinary figure of the High Middle Ages shows us that juggling the demands of daily life and the demands of our spiritual life is not impossible.
This great man of the Church continues to inspire us by his example of an active ministry nourished by study, profound contemplation, and constant prayer.
But exactly who was Rabanus Maurus? It would appear he was many things. A monk, a poet, a theologian, an advisor to princes, and a composer.
Rabanus entered monastic life at a young age as an oblate, was trained in the liberal arts, and received a broad formation in the Christian tradition. As the abbot of Fulda, and then the archbishop of Mainz, he contributed through his vast learning and pastoral zeal to the unity of the empire and the transmission of a Christian culture deeply nourished by the scriptures and the fathers of the Church.
Pope Benedict said Rabanus was a formative voice in the Carolingian culture of 8th century Germany who knew how to maintain the bond with the culture of the past and the theological and spiritual culture of the present. So much so, he was also called Preceptor Germaniae. He is the author of De Laudibus Sancte Crucis, and among his many writings there is also perhaps one of the most beautiful hymns in the entire Church, Veni Creator Spiritus. Christian faith, concluded Pope Benedict XVI, is not thought alone. It touches us at every level of our being, and as such, we too must search for God in all the dimensions of our existence. I'm Emer McCarthy.
And a big thank you there to Emer McCarthy for bringing us the Pope's words this Wednesday. And now I'd like to join Consultant for Jewish Affairs at the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, Father Dennis McManus, whom I met late last year discovering a special connection with Jesuit historian Father Robert Graham.
Father Graham was a Jesuit who was originally assigned in Rome to La Civiltà Cattolica, and I think he was a staff editor and author. And one fine day, as I understand it, he was asked to visit Secretary of State. And in that secretariat, they asked him to take special charge of a project. And the project was to collect everything he could find, both in the Vatican archives, government cables, libraries, media reports, interviews, anything he could find on the relationship of Pope Pius with the Jewish communities of Europe, especially during the war years. So Father Graham was astounded and pleased, from what I understand, to be asked to do this, and spent the next 25 to 30 years doing exactly that, and had carte blanche admittance to anything he needed in the Holy See. Secret archives, papers, nunciature correspondence, chancelleries across Europe. He made the rounds and really put together a fabulous collection of papers. He also worked, as you alluded, under another Jesuit, Father Blay, who was the chairman of a working group that put together these huge cross-sample section of documents from the Vatican archives about what went on between the Holy See and different governments during the war years, most especially relative to saving the Jews, relations with the Jews of the Holy See, Pope Pius's own interventions on many occasions, the Holy See's exchanges with military authorities, governments, prisoner of war camps, anything at all. The Jesuit fathers did a very long, detailed examination of what was in the archives and took what they felt was a representative cross-section of documents there. Father Graham was a part of that team, and today those 11 volumes are really the most important set of documents we have on the whole issue.
Now, Father Graham lived in Rome during the German occupation. He knew Papa Pacelli personally, yet he started working on these volumes in the 1960s.
That's correct. I think it was 1963 he was first asked to take a look at this. And from what I understand, he had already done a brilliant volume in Geneva of his own on Vatican diplomacy in Europe. It became standard reading at the Academia and a few other places for the training of diplomats, and still is quite an excellent volume, historically speaking. So I think what happened was his talent was spotted by the Holy See after the publication of that book.
Pope Benedict has recently opened the Vatican archives relative to the pontificate of Pius XI. The ordinary person, the man on the street, doesn't have access to the Vatican archives relative to the pontificate of Pius XII. How does this documentation that Father Graham put together stand compared to the Vatican archives, do you think, in your opinion?
I'm not sure. The problem in front of us as archivists and historians is that Father Graham's collection was sent home when he became ill here in Rome, sent home with him back to his California province of the Jesuit fathers, and it was integrated into the Jesuit archives of California. When I was called to take a look at it 10 years ago, it was at that time 250 portfolio size boxes, and it's an immense amount of material. My estimation, 25,000 separate documents. And they are not yet cataloged or accessed. They are now here in Rome. They are at the Jesuit Generalate on the Borgo Santo Spirito. And I've been invited by Father Gumpel to come back and take a look.
Father Gumpel is the relator of the cause for the beatification of Pius XII.
Exactly. So what we have to do, I think, is reassess everything in Father Graham's collection and see what there is new, what the Vatican Archives has and does not have. I think in Father Graham's collection are going to be wonderful surprises. Personal interviews, eyewitness accounts, cablegrams, all kinds of exchanges between governments, some of which the Vatican Archives would have and some of which would be on hand in different dioceses and other chancelleries of governments in Europe, but many of which were secret in nature, were ciphered cablegrams, and Father deciphered them with the help of others during the war. And I think what you have here is a potential treasure trove of information about how the Holy Father, Pius XII, made extraordinary efforts to help save Jewish lives during the war.
From what you said, there are 11 volumes which are bound, and then there's other documentation as well. Is that clear?
Yes. The bound volumes were done some years back as an initial look-through of what was in the Vatican archives. Since that time, and under the generosity of Pope John Paul II and also our current Holy Father Benedict XVI, the archives have intensified their efforts to assess and catalog and make available everything year by year through the pontificate of Pius XI. So I think this year the archives are now open through the year 1939. And next year we begin 1940s, and it's 1939 through 1945, which are most critical to the questions of Pius XII and the Jews. These are going to be big years for all of us interested.
But did you think that Father Graham's documentation is going to be published at all? Or?
We're hoping. I would love to see a project whereby a group of scholars, perhaps Catholic and Jewish together, could assess what's in Father Graham's collection and at least see it digitalized and then bound and made available for historians and archivists to begin reading.
But there's going to be a team of people working on this.
Well, that would be the proposal. So far, there's no decision taken, but that would be the idea.
You were listening there to the consultant for Jewish Affairs of the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, Father Dennis McManus. You can hear the second part of this interview at this same time on Friday, 12th of June. Meanwhile, on a far more arty note, I'd like to take you with me deep in the heart of the Vatican, to the Sistine Chapel, where our guide, Professor of Fine Arts, Breda Ennis, breaks away from Michelangelo's masterpiece and takes a look at a Botticelli masterpiece on the walls there. Breda, we're going to take a look at a wall painting in the
yes.
Sistine Chapel on mm-hmm. the left-hand side if you mm. come in through the main entrance.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to give Michelangelo a miss and go over to Botticelli. It depicts the punishment of Korah, Dathan and Abiram.
Mm,
right?
In fact, yes.
So what's so special about this?
Well, it's Botticelli is always special. And people tend to just think of Botticelli in relation to those famous paintings of his in the Uffizi in Florence. But here you have him dealing with a very strong religious subject, an Old Testament scene. And putting his marvellous talent and his very light way of putting lines, his very vaporous way of putting colours. Every scene in his paintings or in his frescoes tends to have a fluidity. And the same applies to this particular fresco. When you're looking at frescoes in the Sistine Chapel, the ones on the left are part of a series from the Old Testament, and the ones on the right are part of a series from the New Testament, done by various painters. They all have a link between them in terms of like stylistic link, but when you look at them individually, you can see the real painter per se, but they have worked in harmony. But you can look at the individual part when you look at them individually. So here you have in the background on the top part, like all of the other paintings, frescoes in Sistine and the wall paintings, you have this very pallid landscape going way, way back. A lovely sense of space at the back of the painting. I just call it a painting instead of a fresco because it feels very painterly to me, this piece. Then on the top part, you have a dark blue sky with white clouds, very clearly defined. And then you have three sets of buildings. You have what looks like a church on the left-hand side. On the right-hand side, you have the remains of a building from the Roman Forum. And in the middle, you have, in the background, you have an Arch of Constantine. And you can look through the Arch of Constantine into the distant part of the landscape. On the left of the arch, you have a hill with some trees and a church halfway up and a ship. You can see the ship actually docked right near the edge of the Arch of Constantine, which obviously is not possible in reality, but it looks lovely there. And then on the right-hand side of the arch is a tree on its own. And then various little bits of building. And then in front of all this, you have all the activity, the main story of this marvellous scene here, where rebels who rebelled against the authority of Moses, they refused to acknowledge his authority and insisted that Aaron is an usurper of the office of priest. So they are put to the test. And the actual title reads, The Rebellion Against Moses, the Lawgiver. So the prophet, standing before the altar, invokes the name of God against the rebels while their tuna fires fall to the ground, and Aaron alone is spared by God. So the rebels, cursed by God, are swallowed by the earth, and their 250 followers are devoured by fire. Now, this again, you can see that the followers are all into groups and kept back from Moses. Now, you see Moses here three times on the same fresco. On the right, where he's being challenged. In the middle, where he is condemning. And on the left-hand side, where the sentence is being executed. So two of the followers, Dathan and Abiram, are thrown into the ground, into the earth. They're swallowed up, literally, with all the other followers eventually. And Korah himself only is saved. So here you can see in the middle that Moses looks very priestly, because his robes give you the feeling of a senator. So they come very near to paper vestments, in a sense. Of, for example, in the center part you have Moses imperiously holding up a golden rod. And where he's holding it up towards Korah. And Korah is contorted, his body is twisted, and it's almost like he's being hit by a power which is stronger than him. And this is the power, obviously, that saves him, while his other two companions are thrown to the ground, turned over and falling, dressed in blue and dressed in gold, these two who are falling. And the peculiar thing about this golden rod that Moses is holding is, in the past, the Pope himself was given a rod of authority. Meaning the rod to discern and to punish where necessary. So it has a relevance in terms of the papacy, because we must never forget that in the Sistine Chapel, anything that you find on any fresco has some relationship to the successor of Peter and his role. There's another aspect here which is curious as well. For example, the three figures of Moses. If you look at his forehead, he has two clusters of rays each side of his forehead. This relates to the fact that when Moses came down from Sinai the second time, he had rays coming out of his forehead. Find in the past Moses painted with two little horns, but when Saint Jerome translated the Bible into Latin, he did not want light on anyone before Christ. So this is why they transformed these rays of light into horns. But how they resolved them, this painting here, was that they made, say, the horns divide into 10 golden rays. And some people think maybe that this could also be relevant, or could be represent the Ten Commandments.
He has the same robe, the same coloured robe, yes, three times.
Yeah. Because Moses here, in the sense, is a priest. A lawgiver. This again relates to where this fresco is in the Sistine Chapel, relating to the Pope.
But it's really unusual to have the same figure three times in one fresco, no?
Well, he's turned it into a kind of a triptych. And this was a habit also in many of the works of Botticelli, where he's tended to divide his paintings or his frescoes into three sections. So you have one on the left, one in the middle, and one on the right. So hence you're repeating the figure with Moses on the right, who's defending himself, with Moses in the middle, who is carrying out God's judgment, so to speak, and Moses on the extreme left, punishing the wrongdoers. the centre part of the painting, just before the Art of Constantine, you see flames coming up where there are figures who are burning incense. There was the habit also in the past when the new pope rode in procession from St. Peter's to take possession, let's say, the ceremonially possessed, or the ceremonial possession of St. John Lateran's, he would have priests all along the route covering him with incense as he passed by. So this kind of incense here in this particular painting is used in the wrong sense, because the six figures here that you can see in the background in the centre are offering false fire to the Lord.
Why false fire?
Because it's not offered in the proper sense. They are not obedient. They are not recognizing the true God. So, for example, if you look at the Art of Constantine here, there's a curious little detail which maybe is not noticed very often. Right on the top of the arch, there is a collection of rocks and stones. You see them there on top?
Yeah.
Now, again, there's a constant reference in the Sistine Chapel artworks of any type to stones and rocks. And again, we're coming back to, upon this rock I will build my church. Since here, the rocks are not put in an even way on the top. It's strange because if you look at the arch itself, it's very carefully done, it's meticulous. It's again, it's with all the golden decoration on a silvery kind of background. Again, gold and silver, the papal keys. And then again, you see the rocks on the top. So it's a sort of mysterious factor here, the way the rocks are put. They're just very casually put on top, as if somebody just put a whole bunch of rocks and stones on top of the Arch of Constantine, which is unusual. So it's hard to know what the meaning could have been. But anyway, archways, for example, the arches also relate, apart from the obvious relationship with pagan art or the early Roman period or whatever, when the Pope went in procession across the city for any reason, especially on Palm Sunday, they used to build temporary arches to follow his route so he would pass under these arches. And then these were dismantled, obviously, after the Palm Sunday. So the arch became rather important in this sense also for the papal position. And this is why we tend to see lots of arches in the frescoes, the wall paintings in the Sistine Chapel. And most times we think, well, why are so many of them there? But I think they're all related to papal procession. Because you have the papal entourage coming into Sistine Chapel. They're all coming under the open door. They're going under the arch of the rood screen and they're walking up to the altar. Even the Last Judgment fresco in itself has a sense of the arch to the way the figures are put. And again, this is leading his people as the Pope does the Catholic Church.
Heartfelt thanks once again to Professor of Fine Arts, Breda Ennis, who is currently working at the American University of Rome and was also an artist herself. Finally, we join scripture scholar Archbishop Mark Coleridge, who tells us precisely about this giant figure from our family tree of faith.
Let me start by saying that there's very much more of Moses in each one of us than we usually think. So what I'd like to do is to introduce you to this very grand forebear of ours, the liberator and the lawgiver. Now, sometimes we think of Moses as the archetypal Jew, or perhaps as some kind of Charlton Heston with a big beard and an even bigger staff in his hand looming over the Red Sea in heroic style. But the fact is that Moses would have looked and sounded very much more Egyptian than Jewish. His name, in fact, Moses, is itself Egyptian. and there are lots of traces of Egypt in the stories we find about him in the Bible. Even the Ten Commandments read very like the rules of entrance inscribed on the doors of Egyptian temples. Now, this is because he was raised in the royal court, found in the bulrushes, raised in the court, very much a man of the establishment, probably speaking with a plum in his mouth, although with a stutter, it seems. Certainly he wasn't a good speaker, he says that himself. So he's not the kind of man you'd expect to be a liberator. But the princeling seems to have had a ferocious temper, and eventually he turns killer. He murders an Egyptian who was terrorizing one of the Hebrews, his own people, whom Moses seems never to have forgotten completely. In fact, Moses seems to have had a kind of identity crisis of the kind not unknown today, deciding that he was really a Hebrew rather than an Egyptian, no matter how he looked or how he sounded. At this point, the killer takes to the hills and becomes a shepherd, which must have been tough for the courtier, learning the ways of the desert. But then, after the burning bush, he reappears at court as the liberator, stamping his foot and demanding freedom for those whom he now calls my people. Caught then between the devil and the deep Red Sea, the waters open, and through they charge to freedom. You know the story. Only then to find themselves wandering in the wilderness, feeling that God has led them not up the garden path, but up the desert path, wanting to go back to Egypt, where at least, they say, we had roast dinners with leeks and cucumbers. For decades, Moses had to put up with his people's whinging, despite everything that he had done for them. As the old poem puts it, Moses was the leader of the Israelitic flock. He used to get spar water by just tapping on a rock. One day from out the multitude there came a mighty cheer. Instead of getting water, he got pints of ice-cold beer. But the cheers, I'm afraid, ran out with the beer, and the whinging went on. The man of a ferocious temper had to learn the way of patience. That was his journey. The man of faith also had his doubts out in the desert, which is why, having struck the rock not once but twice, he's told that he'll see but never enter the promised land. As he lay dying on the mountains of Moab in modern-day Jordan, looking across the Dead Sea to the promised land, Moses must have been dismayed by the moonscape that he saw. And he must have wondered if God couldn't perhaps have done better than this. Perhaps he even thought back to the soft life of Egypt. But then breathed his last with not a hint of regret, because he had in fact made the greatest journey of all. Today there's not a trace of the tomb of Moses. Fascinating that. Not a trace of it. Because in fact he's buried everywhere, especially in our hearts.
You were listening there to Scripture scholar, Archbishop of Canberra and Goulburn in Australia, Mark Coleridge. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks for listening. Should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now. And don't forget, we'll be back again at this same time tomorrow. Laudetur Jesus Christus.